Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And welcome to America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to talk to a couple of Wisconsin ladies who live right next door to each other. In fact, they share a driveway. And recently they found out they share a whole lot more than that. And you won't believe how they discovered it. Wait till you hear their stories coming up in about 10 minutes. And then later in the show, we're going to talk to another great researcher from Legacy Tree Genealogist, Bob Call, talking about land and property records and what they can do for you as you're seeking your ancestors, especially those from before 1850. Right now, let's head out to Boston and talk to my good friend David Allen Lambert. He's the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. Boy, you're traveling a lot this summer. David, what are you up to next?
One of our listeners, Michael Levine, has invited me to be their speaker for the 43rd Bomb Group at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania on July 28th and 29th. I'm very much looking forward to that. And the great part of that is I'm going to actually go out and fire Thompson machine guns with World War II veterans.
You're kidding me. That is the coolest thing ever.
It really is. But the week before that, I'll be at the Abrams Seminar in Lansing, Michigan at the Michigan State Archives. And the week before that, I will be at the SAR Congress in Houston, Texas. So busy, busy July for me.
Yes, you are everywhere. And of course, at FGS coming up in August, I'm going to be the keynote speaker for the opening session on Wednesday the 22nd. That's in Fort Wayne, Indiana. So if you're in the Midwest, come on out and join us and find out all kinds of new things, some great tools in your journey to discover your family history.
Yeah, I'll be your sidekick out there as well.
That's right. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right. What's going on this week with our family histoire news, David?
Well, I'll tell you, I got a great story, and I like to attribute this to ancestral scratch tickets. Because you know that scratch ticket you just kind of scrape away, and I'm like, nah, it's not a winner. How about old daguerreotypes? Daguerreotypes, the earliest form of photography, sometimes will tarnish and fade away. Well, with a new high-energy X-ray, the National Gallery in Canada has determined that they can now see the images below the tarnish. And there's a great example on Extreme Genes on the Facebook page with a link right to it that shows you this girl that sort of comes out of the mist, if you will.
Out of the mist is right. It's unbelievable. And you know, a few years ago, remember on the show, we talked about an experiment that I did with Ron Fox on a couple of my daguerreotypes. And one of them we completely rescued. It was phenomenal. So we went on to a second one, and it really started to damage it. And I had to rescue it from the rescue because it got a lot worse. And I'm really kind of disappointed the way that came out. If we'd had this, we'd have never taken a chance like that with electrolysis as the means to rescue a daguerreotype.
That's true. Well, I'll tell you, sometimes a rescue can be many years later. In this case, it's 79 years later where a daughter got to meet her mother, and not graveside. Her 100-year-old mother is alive and well, and both of them thought in 1938 the other had died. Joanne Lowenstern, age 79, found out at the age of 16 that she was actually adopted, but her mother had died shortly after she was born in a hospital in the Bronx in New York. And the same is true for Lillian Simoneri, who was 100, thinking that her daughter had died after she was born. An emotional reunion. The video is heart-wrenching. Amazing to think that DNA can bring people together. Who would ever thought a 79-year-old would still have their mother still alive?
That's incredible. And had both of them tested, David?
I believe so. It was all via DNA.
Wow.
via Ancestry.com.
Yeah. Wow.
Our next discovery is a little further east. It is at Marawa Island at the United Arab Emirates in the Arabian Gulf. They found this island has a settlement that dates back 8,000 years ago, and it's been perfectly preserved under the sand dunes for all these years.
That's incredible.
Iron Age. So if you have ancestors from your DNA that point from the Iron Age in Arabia, who knows what DNA they may be digging up for you now. So, you know, it's funny what people dig up. And every time I go, I look up in the old home movies and whatnot. But sometimes you might have a home movie that might have some startling historical relevance. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as many know, suffered from polio early on and was wheelchair bound. They actually have an Easter video from 1935 that a gentleman from New York named Fred Hill filmed, and it shows FDR actually walking with a cane.
It's unbelievable footage, and it's on extremejeans.com. You know, the press photographers were not allowed to record him walking because they didn't want to see the hobble that he had. They didn't want to display that to the American public. But this guy, he didn't know. It was just his home movie camera, and he caught some amazing footage with it.
It's quite amazing, and like I say, if you've never seen this, I would definitely go to extremejeans.com, which I suggest people go to all the time because you get the Family History News live as
That's right,
posted.
As we find it, exactly.
My blogger spotlight this week shines upon Amanda Knapper's blog, sillymummyfamilytree.blogspot.com, where she talks about her British ancestry and gives a great little snippet of this and that on her ancestors that she found, which is another reason why you should become a blogger, everyone, and tell us about your family so we can get great content to possibly have you on Extreme Genes.
There you go. And you know, the fun part about this is, too, is we really learn from each other about records and record sets that might be out there to help us in our own journey.
That really is true. And I know that there's some exciting things coming down the road with Reclaim the Records, and hopefully we'll get an insight into that soon, too. Well, that's all I have from Beantown. Just remember, if you're not a member of American Ancestors, you can save $20 by using the checkout code EXTREME and save $20 on your membership, which is regularly $89.95. Have a great summer and hope to see some of you at FGS or elsewhere on your travels.
All right. Thanks so much, David. And coming up next, two Wisconsin women who share a driveway. Yeah, they're right next door to each other, but they share something even more, and they didn't learn about it until only recently. Wait till you hear this story. Coming up next in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Hey, welcome back. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. This segment is brought to you by FamilySearch.org. And as we mentioned before the break, you know, there are things that happen in family history research that are just unexplainable. And the story of my next two guests really falls into that category. They're in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Meet Hillary and Dawn. How are you, ladies?
Hi, we're good.
You guys, I mean, you're next door neighbors. You share a driveway, right?
Yeah. Correct.
All right. Now, Hillary, you're the younger of the two ladies here. You're, what, about 31 years old?
And I am 31.
31. And as I understand it, you're an adoptee. And like a lot of adoptees, you want that hole in your life kind of filled. You want to figure out where you came from. And your family situation was that you came from an open adoption. In other words, the records weren't hidden too much for you. So you were able to get access pretty easily, yes?
Yes.
So where did you go to find out about your background?
I was adopted from Catholic Charities. I thought it was going to be much more challenging, but all I did was go online to their website and filled out some information. And within a day, actually, the very next day, I got a call from the lady there that said my adoption is an open adoption and that they had all my records.
Come and get it, huh?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
They ended up sending a packet in the mail then in the next couple of days. I just have been waiting for my whole life. So.
Well, now, tell me about that. I mean, you were how old when you decided to look? And how long had you been wanting to look?
Well, in 2012 was when I started this actual search.
Okay.
That's when I became pregnant with my daughter, Stella.
Okay, so you're about 25, you're starting your own family, and you want to know.
Yes, for health reasons, and I just really wanted to know, just mostly for Stella's sake and for my sake, and I knew it was finally time to get some answers.
Sure.
And I have wanted to know my whole life. Ever since I can recall, I knew I was adopted. My parents have told me, so, I mean, forever, I couldn't wait till I was old enough and could find out more information.
Could do that. So you finally got around to it, and so you went to work, and you found some interesting information in there.
Yes, in the pamphlet, the very first page, I was able to see what my birth mother's name was, where she lived, and then in the next paragraph, they said who my birth father was, but unfortunately, he passed away in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
The obituary was in my packet.
Which kind of led you now to next of kin?
Yes. In the packet, I was able to see that I had two half-sisters that I had the same father, and then I had two half-brothers from the same mother.
Different mom. Were you able to find these people?
Yes. I was able to find my two half-brothers on Facebook, actually, pretty much that day, I think, I went on.
Wow.
And I was able to find them because their last name is not very common. And I knew I could tell immediately that they looked like me and resembled me. And I had their address, like where they were from. So I knew that that was them.
Okay.
And they accepted my request without even knowing who I was. So I was fortunate enough for that.
Yeah.
And I kind of kept it a secret for a while from them. I didn't confront them even until 2015, actually. I just kind of held it all in because I was nervous about telling them. I just,
sure.
Asking them. I didn't know if they knew I existed. You know, I always didn't want to step on anyone's toes or ruin anything. But
it's a touchy thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I was not able to locate my sister. Her name was Dawn Johnson.
Okay.
From my father's obituary and from the other stuff in the packet. I mean, I would go on Facebook and type in Dawn Johnson, and I would get a billion Dawn Johnsons.
Mm-hmm. This whole family was around your area there in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, pretty close. You know, come to find out, my birth mother lived an hour and a half away from me my whole life, and my two half-brothers, and then Dawn lived 2 hours away from me.
Right. Now, let's talk to your neighbor, Dawn, here. Now, Dawn, you moved in only last year, right?
That is correct. We purchased the house in June of 2017.
Okay. And you share this driveway with Hillary, and Hillary's got a little girl, 4 years old, who I understood took quite a shine to you.
Yes. I found out her name was Stella, and she was so intrigued. She always wanted to come over, find out what I was doing, and I was mostly by myself during the day, as my significant other, Kurt, worked nights, so he slept during the day at our other house in Greenwood. And she would constantly come over, and it was wonderful to have a little girl around who was so intrigued in everything that I was doing.
How'd you feel about that, Hillary? Were you okay with that?
Not exactly, no. I had not met the neighbors yet, and I constantly tell Stella, I'm like, Stella, stop going over there. We don't even know them. No, Mom, they're really nice. They really like me. I'm like, well, I would constantly tell her to not go over there because I'm like, you know, just wasn't sure. And but she insisted. I couldn't stop her. She would literally just share the same driveway, so she wasn't far away, but she would constantly be over there.
So she introduced you, basically, to the new neighbors.
Yeah, she made me want to get to know them, maybe,
yeah.
A little bit.
And you found out their names were Kurt and Dawn.
I did, yes.
Did you find that kind of intriguing?
I did find that intriguing. My husband was talking to Dawn when they met, and she told him that she was from the Greenwood area, that her name was Dawn. And he came inside and told me, he's like, I met the new neighbors. And Dawn, she's from Greenwood. And it hit me right away from my father's obituary. It said, Dawn Johnson from the Greenwood area.
Yeah.
So it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I told Lance, I was like, my husband, Do you get it? Like, Dawn Greenwood? And he's like, what? So brought out my pack of stuff and showed him. And he's like, oh, yeah. We're like, no, there's no way. No. So uh-huh. We kind of giggled. We're like, well, it could be, but no, you know, we didn't know her last name. And we were just getting ahead of ourselves. So we kind of dropped it for a little bit. There.
Really? So I understand from one account, you actually were staring at her quite a lot. Did that make you uncomfortable, Dawn?
Yeah, it started pouring when we were, me and Kurt were ripping off the shingles on our garage. So we had to obviously come off of the roof and go into the garage. This was in the first part of August. So we were standing in the garage waiting for the weather to pass, and Lance, Hillary, and Stella came over into the garage, and we were all standing there, and it's just a strange feeling, is like she was like staring at me from moving around all angles of me. Now, mind you, I haven't really talked at all. It was basically, you know, a wave, a smile, and that was about it. Stella was the one that I had more association with. So it was a little strange having this person stare at me. And as we were leaving, pulling out of the driveway, because we were not staying overnight here yet. The house wasn't ready to sleep there. So we were leaving, Kurt and I, out of the driveway. And Kurt turned to me and he said, what was up with Hillary? She wouldn't even let me an inch in between you and her to put the rest of the stuff away. I said, I have no idea. So, you know, we just left it at that and went home to Greenwood and took a shower. And that's the same night that all these strange text messages just kept coming through, because we gave our phone number to Lance in case something happened while we weren't here, because we weren't here all the time working on the house. I just out of the blue, I'm getting text messages from the neighbors. So.
Now, Hillary, you had seen something, though, that kind of clued you in that this might really be your half-sister. And what was that?
Yes. Early August, there was a very large truck that pulled in our driveway, our shared driveway, a pack of shingles. And on the shingles, there's a huge red banner. I mean, 20 feet long. It was huge. And it said Johnson plastered across the side of the shingles. And I was home alone. I lost it. I thought, oh my gosh, it's Dawn Johnson. Like, oh my gosh, she's from Greenwood. This is how many Dawn Johnsons live in Greenwood. It's a small town, right? I mean, I'm going crazy.
Yeah.
Call my husband. I'm like, did I call her? Her name is Johnson. He said, oh my gosh, yeah, you got to ask her. I'm like, I'm not going to ask her, like, you know, who her dad is or whatever. I'm like, I'm not just going to go ask her, like, how's this happening? I didn't even know for sure still.
Sure.
Until I started asking her those random questions.
And this is where the crazy texting thing began, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. And then finally you just came out with it?
Finally, yeah. I asked her a little series of questions from stuff I knew. I started off with asking if she was the Miss Loyal Cornfest Queen, because I had known from my father's obituary that Dawn Johnson was Miss Loyal Cornfest Queen. And she said, yes, why? And then I pretty much just blurted out after that. I just said, who's your birth dad? Who's your dad? And she said, Wayne Clough, our father's name. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2010. And my husband was sitting there and we were screaming. It was 9:30 at night, and I'm screaming, crying, joyful, scared because I still haven't told her who I am. So then I texted her and I said, we have a lot to talk about. Can I call you? And she said, sure.
Dawn, what was your feeling when you heard this? Did you know that Hillary existed?
No, I actually did not meet my birth father till I was 18. So we never had a really close father-daughter relationship. It was quite a shock because I put together the text messages, you know, those three questions that she asked me, and I knew they were my father's obituary, and I knew Hillary was adopted from her husband, Lance. I picked up the phone, and she said, you know how I told you I was adopted? And I said, yeah. Well, I know who my birth father is. And at that instant, with all them questions and her stating that, I said, you and me have the same dad, don't we? I said, oh, my God.
And just insane.
You know, there's not enough words to describe, you know, the feeling.
No.
It was just, like, in shock. And I'm like, I wasn't upset. I was very grateful. It was just, oh, my God, I got another sister out there. How wonderful. And that means Stella's my niece.
That's right. Little Stella.
You know, and it's so weird because we looked at 20-plus houses in the city, and they go extremely fast. And we found this house, and the only thing we did not like about it was the shared driveway.
The shared driveway.
Yeah.
That is an incredible story, ladies.
Yeah.
And I'm so happy for both of you. This is an amazing thing.
Thank
and
you.
Your family circles expanded. And I can tell, I'm sure you've told this story already 100 times to one outlet or another, but it still impacts you just as you repeat it, right?
Yeah, it still impacts. I'm not kidding. I get goosebumps and chills every time almost. We will cry sometimes. It's never gets old, I'll tell you that.
Never gets old. Well, Hillary and Dawn, thank you so much for coming on Extreme Genes and sharing your story. That's what it's all about in family history research, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
All right. You guys have a great day. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. You too.
And coming up next, we're going to talk to Bob Call. He's going to share some information about how to use land records and property records to identify your ancestors, especially from pre-1850. Coming up in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Welcome back. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and we're talking property records today. And you might think, well, wait a minute, what's that got to do with anything? It has to do with everything if you're struggling with areas like pre-1850 records. And Bob Call is on the line with me today. He's a researcher with my friends at Legacy Tree Genealogists. Bob, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Awesome. You know, I've run into a lot of people lately who are kind of new to the game, and property records is really a great way to go. And I think a lot of people don't understand how much information is buried in some of these things. How long have you been researching property records?
I've used property records probably 7 to 10 years.
7 to 10 years. And there's always some interesting nugget in there because it's not just the legal descriptions of property that you can find. You can get a lot of clues that you just can't get prior to 1850, of course, when the census records started including every member of the household. That changed everything. But before that, this is a great way to discover your ancestors' past, and even after 1850.
Definitely.
So what have you found in there that's kind of unique?
I like property records a lot because they give you clues about family members that can't be found elsewhere in that pre-1850 time period, and especially if a person has died and his or her estate needs to be divided up among the heirs. You'll find second marriages of widows or marriages of daughters or new residences of children who moved away. They really piece together those people who you think may be related, but you just don't have the proof for them yet.
Yeah, right. And also even the witnesses sometimes are related. There's some kind of association there that might even tell you where the deceased came from before that time they were in that particular area.
Yeah, that's very helpful. That can give you a breakthrough that you can't get elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really kind of fun to go through and say, okay, give me all the names here. What is their association? Not only the named relatives where it's plainly stated, but sometimes the witnesses, sometimes the people who are asked to be the executors of the will.
I had one interesting case. We're researching a man named John Anderson who lived in Indiana, and there were about 8 or 9 men with that name in the same county.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly, right? We knew he came from Pennsylvania. Of course, several of those men also came from Pennsylvania. We didn't know where in Pennsylvania, and it was the property records that gave us some really good clues. We were able to look at all of the John Anderson deeds from that county, read through each one carefully, and we came up with a cluster of 3 or 4 different groups of sons and grandsons named John Anderson. And they just like to name the sons and grandsons after each other. So,
which makes things just joyous. It's a good thing they weren't named Smith, you know?
Yeah, it was almost as bad as Smith, but not quite.
But, you know, you really bring up an interesting point here. And as people get into this, and if you're new to it, the reality is that the name isn't always the key thing. I mean, for instance, there's the John Smith who was married to Mary or Audrey or, you know, somebody else who also was a blacksmith, who also had a son named Micajah. You know, I mean, there's all these different things kind of come together. It's the identification isn't made just from the name. And this is a great way to get some of those little details that help you separate them. I've had that with my great-grandfather, Andrew Jackson Fisher. He was a firefighter in New York City in the 10th Ward, but there was another one by the exact same name. And I had to figure out how to separate which one was which because they were both in the papers for various things, for instance, politics and business. And I was finally able to sort them out because you can associate, oh, well, this one has this wife and this one has that wife and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the clues you're looking for and where they lived, too. You know,
yeah, that's right.
Anderson family, I put them in different corners of the county and was able to say, okay, well, we've got different groups here. Let's focus in on the right family so we don't make wrong connections.
And were you able to figure out where back in Pennsylvania they were from as a result of this?
Unfortunately, no. that's the downside. But the good side was one of the deeds for those John Anderson did say in Pennsylvania. So that helped us make sure we didn't follow the wrong family line and get the wrong ancestors.
Sure. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the different clues in the indexes and then maybe some clues in the deeds themselves.
Sure.
When I'm doing research, we've got to prioritize our work, right? And so you may open up a deed book and you're seeing 50 deeds that you might want to look at and think, okay, which ones do I go to first?
Yeah, that drives me nuts. You're absolutely right. There are too many of them. I don't have a lot of time, and the meter's running on my car out on the street.
Exactly, right, yeah. So if we can find little clues even in the indexes that prioritize which deeds we pull first, then we'll be most effective with our research.
Okay, and what do you look for?
The general principle is any sort of notation that doesn't look standard. So you'll in the indexes, you'll have the list of the grantor, which is the seller.
Right.
And then you'll have the grantee, the person they're selling the property to, then usually the volume and page number of the deed.
Mm-hmm.
And anything in addition to those names can be helpful. And so oftentimes you'll see et al or et ux, which means and others and wife.
Mm-hmm.
So there's going to be more names in here, and they're probably family members, and certainly the wife is, right?
Sure.
Also, if you see clues that the person selling the land may have been dead, such as administrator, executor, estate, heirs, anything along those clues are gold mine, and I go for those deeds first.
Sure. The others are just basically transactions that go on throughout the course of a person's life.
Yeah. And those are good, and those can be helpful to give you other types of clues. But when someone has died and they're dividing up the property, that'll give you all sorts of family relationships.
What was the biggest gold mine you've ever found in one deed?
Oh, in one single deed?
Yeah.
But essentially, we had a man who died in Vermont in the 1780s, and we didn't know what happened to his widow or a few of his daughters. But we found the heirs selling property in the 1790s up until the year 1800. And in those deeds, it mentioned that the widow was about to marry a new man. And then another later deed listed her as the wife. So even though we could never find the marriage record, we now had proof of her marriage to a second man, as well as an approximated time period. We were able to determine an approximate time of when a daughter died, and that she died without any heirs herself. We knew the daughter existed, but we did not know who she married. Again, it was not in the marriage records. And we also figured out that there was likely a granddaughter that no one knows about as well.
Wow.
It was two or three deeds, I have to admit.
Okay.
But they were all right there together in the same deed book and all tied together. So.
Sure. Boy, that tells you a lot, doesn't it? And I think mm-hmm. that really explains why property records are so important to refer to when you're stuck. Pre-1850,
yeah.
Especially. Vermont is a terrible area, by the way, for a lot of research into marriages and vital records from that time period. I've looked at it before, and it's like, okay, where did they go? What happened to them?
Yeah. While these towns in Vermont did keep vital records from the 1760s onward, they certainly weren't complete.
No.
These families had all lived in these towns. Some of their vital records were recorded, but these marriages and that granddaughter, they weren't in the vital records for whatever reason. The
mm-hmm.
deeds were necessary for that.
Yeah, the deeds are incredible. So where do people find them?
Deeds in American research are usually at the county level.
Okay.
So they're going to be housed at the county courthouse. Many have been microfilmed by Family Search, the Family History Library. With a warning on that, though, that even though it may look like the Family History Library has all of the deeds for a county, they sometimes don't. And so it can be worth calling the county courthouse, the recorder, and asking them what property records they have.
If there's something more there. And keep in mind, too, Family Search is digitizing pretty much everything. So a lot of this stuff could be available online. How cool is that?
Oh, yes, I love it.
All right, he's Bob Call. He's a researcher with Legacy Tree Genealogists. And we appreciate your time, Bob. Good stuff.
Thank you, Scott. That was a lot of fun.
All right. And coming up next, we're going to talk preservation with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMC Place, coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Well, you probably have them in drawers and cabinets throughout your house, those 1970s era, what they called magnetic photo albums, and there was nothing magnetic about them. Hey, it's Fisher here. Welcome back. It's Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. Talking preservation with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. And Tom, these old magnetic, quote-unquote, photo albums, they are a real pain because they're just constantly destroying these photos.
Oh, they are. I have several of them, and back in the day, we thought they were the coolest thing since sliced bread, and we found out they were nothing but green moldy bread.
Green moldy bread, exactly. In fact, I notice a lot of the pictures that I have in those, and I don't dare take them out because it'll rip a lot of the pictures, but a lot of those photos we have are actually fading, perhaps more than the ones we had back in the 1960s. And I'm wondering if that's just because of the fact that the back of the photo is stuck to this goop and it's actually affecting the image itself.
Yeah, you really had a double whammy with these kind of things, because if you had like the thinner paper prints that some of the cheaper developers use, the actual gooey stuff, which I call a precursor to the Post-it, actually would leach into the picture. And sometimes if you were in like high heat and high humidity areas, it would go all the way through the picture and actually affect the top part of it too. So they could be really, really nasty. And the plastic they used was far from preservation plastic. So just the plastic itself would yellow, would transfer the yellow, and, you know, a little artifact from that would get on the photo. There's just so many bad things that happen with those old, like you say, quote unquote, magnetic magic photo albums.
Yeah. So the question would be, and I hear this from people periodically, they ask me, and I'm sure you hear it as well, should you take pictures out of these magnetic photo albums? Would it save them? Or are they already pretty much damaged by the chemistry? Or should you leave them in and just scan them as such? And if you want to take them out, how would you do it?
Yes, absolutely correct. True to all the above.
Right?
It's kind of crazy. Depends where you lived, how they were stored, which ones you got, which chemicals are actually in them, because there are different manufacturers that made them. One of the biggest problems that you have with those is anytime you run into a situation like this where you think your pictures have been, you know, somehow affected, the first thing you want to do is scan them before you do anything else. And if yours are so bad you can't get them into a scanner without ruining your scanner, that's when you want to get a shot box and put them in your shot box and shoot them with your Nikon or even with your iPhone or your iPad.
Right.
Before you mess with them, you've got some kind of a picture in case something goes really awry when you're actually removing them.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember trying to do this many years ago. I had a great picture. It was me with Mickey Mantle. Can you imagine a better picture than that? And it was in a magnetic photo album. And to remove this picture, it would start to bend the picture and crease it. And, you know, that to me would be the most difficult thing. Is there anything you could actually put onto the photo or into the album itself that might cause the photos to release more easily?
Yeah, there's a couple different things you can try, and you always want to do things one at a time to find out where your circumstances lend the best way to remove them. One thing that's really, really simple, a lot of people never think about, you can go to your local piano store and get some really super thin piano wire, and sometimes you can run those between the photo and the sticky stuff very, very carefully, and it's sharp enough that it's not really going to cut the paper in the photo, but it's sharp enough that it'll kind of release the photo itself. That's a good way to try.
Wow.
Another thing you can do is if you get a little bit of warmth to it, not too much, you want to like set them in the sun because that's going to fade your photo. But if you get a hair dryer and put it on the lowest setting and kind of go over it a little bit very slowly so they don't get too hot, sometimes these wax-based magnetic photo albums will actually release a picture and then you can get them out. But always make sure before you start any of these kind of things, you're thinking of what the next step is. Don't just start taking these out and stacking them on top of each other if you just really messed yourself up really bad.
What great advice. All right, we're going to continue this conversation about those nasty 1970s-era magnetic photo albums and what you can do with them coming up when we return in 3 minutes on Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show. We are back. It is our final segment of Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show for this week. Fisher here, your Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority, and we're talking about those ridiculous magic, quote-unquote, magnetic, quote-unquote, photo albums from the 1970s era that were just nightmares, especially today, because it's destroying our pictures. And we were talking about how to remove them from the photo albums if you chose to do that. And then what happens after that? Because as Tom mentioned, if you pile them up, you're going to create a whole new problem.
Exactly. So what you need to do, you need to make sure you get, I recommend black paper, because most scanners are blind to black paper. Huh. In fact, if you see the good quality scanners, the top of them are usually black, because then it just edits that part out, especially the good Kodak scanners. So what I recommend you do is go to like a stationery store that sells like wedding announcements, because then you can get a little bit heavier paper that they would make a wedding announcement on, you know, that they put the gold print on a black paper, because that
right.
Black is really a strong black. So as you take them out of your album, you set them on these as square as you can. It'll make your scanning process a whole lot better. But if you're in a situation where there's still a lot of sticky stuff on the back that you really want to remove, there's a couple ways to do this. Some people use an archival tape, but you have to be very, very careful. Because if it's a high-tack tape, it's going to stick to your picture, or it's going to ruin your picture on the back and make things even worse. I use this white stuff that you remember back in grade school. It's called tack, T-A-K.
Huh.
It's just this white kind of gooey stuff that's almost like putty. They use to put paper on the wall, so when you take them down, you can rub the putty off, and it doesn't leave any marks, any oil marks or anything. If you get this and roll it into a ball about the size of a BB, and just very carefully touch the wax stuff on the back, a lot of this will come right off. And another thing you can do, which we talked before, is the piano wire that you use to release them. Get that piano wire and do the same thing. Get your picture down nice and flat and very carefully pull the piano wire along the picture, and it'll take most of that waxy substance right off. Because the good part about the bad part is that waxy stuff usually never goes hard. If you've got the kind that has gotten really, really hard, you're pretty much stuck with how it is. But if you want to do something and you can't use a piano wire, you don't want to mess with the tack, another thing you can do is you can get archival tape and actually tape it to the back of the picture covering the bad part. And then that'll keep it from sticking to your scanner. So when you scan them, your picture will be fine and it's not that much of a thickness that's going to mess things up. But you always want to make sure when you do anything like that, you're going to want to get some black cardboard, the thin paper cardboard, and put on the top of it just to make sure that nothing transfers to the top part of your scanner. Because when you close it, if it transfers to that, then it's going to transfer the next photos. It's going to get on your glass. It's going to cause all kinds of problems. We even have people that go and get what is called museum glass, which is a really super high grade of glass. Put that on the top of your pictures, and it won't affect any of your scanner resolutions. And if you have some stuff that's transferred to the front that you can't get that off or don't want to try destroying it, make sure you get the museum glass and put it on the glass scanner before you set your pictures down. Because when you're done, you can take the glass out and wash it. And if something happens to it, if it gets scratched, no big deal. But if you scratch the glass that came with your scanner, you're going to really have a big problem on your hands.
Oh, boy, you have said that all so well. And I know there are people taking notes on this right now because we all have these things from back in the day. And if we didn't make them ourselves, our parents did and left them with us. And you don't want to lose these pictures. Great advice, Tom. Thanks so much. And we'll talk to you again next week.
My pleasure.
Hey, that's it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us, and I hope you're having a great summer and taking advantage of some of this great time to be together with family, to get stories and photographs and share photographs and scan photographs. I mean, there's so much work to be done. And if you want to find out more, you want to stay in tune, don't forget to sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter at extremejeans.com or on our Facebook page. Talk to you again next week. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.